This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. And let's get patriotic for a moment. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. What a preamble, huh? The United States Founding Fathers signed the Constitution on September 17, 1787. The majority putting pen to parchment that day were slave owners. They were wealthy, and they were white. Of course, they were also men, and it's been a few years since the Constitution was signed. So how perfectly is that union functioning for the people now? Over the next 3 weeks, every Tuesday, we'll try to answer that question and to explore how American civic life has changed since that September day almost 235 years ago. Along with our partners at Northwest Public Broadcasting, Spokane Public Radio, and Humanities Washington. Of course, as long as we're asking questions about the notion of a more perfect union, we're also curious about whether we should be aiming for perfect at all.
You know, the word perfect seems so hard to achieve. And I guess I would say a more better union. And what does that mean to me? I would say it is people being seen and really heard. I think for most people, no matter what your background is, no matter where you come from, most of us just want to be seen for who we are and to be heard. So if we raise our voice, we want to be heard. If we decide to talk in a whisper, we want to be heard. And I think when people feel that they're heard and seen, then things are much, much better for everyone involved, and in our case, in our society.
That's Judge Faye Chess of the Seattle Municipal Court. She spoke with Northwest Public Broadcasting's Dori Luzo-Gilmore. For Judge Chess, creating a better union rather than a perfect union is about finding middle ground.
I think first is you got to stop expecting people to look or speak or live as you do. Come to the recognition that differences are better. This country has had a hard time embracing people's difference. There has been this concept that everyone should be one, that there should be this melting pot. And when you talk about a melting pot, then that means you're breaking down people's individualities. And so first you got to get people to understand is difference is beautiful.
It's also about remembering that we're human. Perfect may not exist, but we can try for better.
Well, I think that one of the things all of us might accept as human beings that we all come with our own biases. And it's not that the expectations are that you will get rid of those biases, is that you will learn how to put them in a place that they should be and let them not dominate your thought process about someone. One of the things that happens is people stop engaging. They stop participating. They stop reaching out. But I think that people would do much better if they got outside of their comfort zone. Participate in the events that are happening in their community.
That kind of engagement is what we're focusing on for today's show, and particularly how we talk and teach about our democracy. After all, how can you create a more perfect or even a better union if you don't know how the system works? Over the past decade, calls for better civic education in American schools have accelerated. Encouraged by civic education groups, state legislatures beefed up requirements for civics courses, particularly in high schools. But some of the attitudes dividing politicians over libraries and classroom instruction are now showing up in how states design and manage civic education standards. Spokane Public Radio's Brandon Hollingsworth takes it from here.
In concept, civics education enjoys that rarest of qualities, bipartisan support from Washington's progressive governor, Jay Inslee.
We can't do this once every 4 years. This is a day-to-day operation. It's like eating breakfast. And democracy, if it's going to be maintained, is a daily exercise.
To conservative Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch.
It's important if we, the people, are going to run our government that we know what it is, how it works, and how we can participate in it.
But in the last couple of years, as the people who make policy see elections, demographics, and history through drastically different lenses, a kind of backlash has formed. Some state legislatures and governors are moving to limit what can be talked about in civic education and social studies courses.
Just a day after Governor DeSantis came to Southwest Florida to announce he wants to spend millions of your tax dollars to pay for civics lessons in schools, his comments about race have a lot of Floridians wondering what his definition of civics is.
Texas Senate passed a bill that's causing a lot of controversy because it would remove key moments of history from being taught in public social studies classes.
All of this is reflective of where we are now as an electorate. Despite the nonpartisan aims of civic education advocates, some of the people who decide the boundaries of a curriculum are political figures, and they make political decisions. The architecture of Washington's civic education strategy is pretty similar to that of other states. The state sets basic requirements, and the details of implementation are left up to school districts.
You know, the legislation sort of outlines what districts are responsible for providing, and then districts get to make that choice as to how they do that.
Jerry Price is a former social studies teacher who today supervises Washington's social studies program for public schools.
What it means for social studies in Washington State is that districts have leeway to make choices as far as what civics curriculum or materials they choose to bring into the classroom.
When Washington's current civics ed law was under consideration in 2018, only one person signed up to testify against it, the then superintendent of the Reardon-Edwall School District in western Spokane County. Legislative records say he was concerned that state guidelines for civic ed would reduce local control. But civic education advocate Margaret Fisher says what goes on in a high school civics class is still controlled at the local level.
If you look at the standards, they don't dictate the curriculum. They dictate, you know, here are some content. How are you going to present that content? And teachers have flexibility around that.
There's also a role for outside groups. They can provide curriculum materials or guest speakers. The Washington League of Women Voters is active in that area, and Fisher is helping develop a street law program for Spokane Public Schools. On the other hand, there's nothing stopping a teacher from inviting, for example, MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell to share myths about voter fraud. Fisher says that is a possibility, but she trusts teachers to differentiate between sources and perspectives to give children a comprehensive picture of thorny and complex issues.
If it's false information, there'd be some discretion exercised there. But if there are different viewpoints, one would hope that the people of the different viewpoints could come in and demonstrate that we may disagree, but we can still have a civil conversation around it.
In other states, there's a struggle brewing over the direction of civic education and who gets to have a hand on the tiller. According to policy analysis website Governing, state lawmakers across the country submitted 120 bills in 2021 and 22 that sought to change or put boundaries on what can be covered in civics and social studies classes and what teachers are required to do. Those fault lines over standards and curriculum have also appeared in the legislature in Olympia. In January, 7 Republican state House members proposed a measure, House Bill 1807, that would require some focused civics ed instruction in K-8 classrooms. The bill's lead sponsor, Representative Jim Walsh, says he thinks Washington civics teachers are doing a good job. But Walsh also wants to get in front of what he says is a national trend of focusing on negative aspects of the country's history and development.
I'd like our civics education to emphasize so many good things in Washington and in the United States, rather than focusing only on criticisms and negative reactions.
The standards presented in House Bill 1807 in some ways mirror those already in place for high school civics, how government works at federal, state, and local levels, history of Washington's indigenous peoples, and basics of civic engagement. But unlike the high school standards, 1807 includes a lot of specifics. That includes an emphasis on almost two dozen documents, from the Declaration of Independence to Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. The bill also bars requiring teachers to attend any training rooted in critical race theory or other concepts conservatives find objectionable. One point raised by Walsh's fellow House Education Committee members is whether that kind of specificity, carved into state law, violates the principle of local control. Walsh says he doesn't think so.
The bill still gives a great deal of latitude to the local school districts to make the final form of their civics courses to their choosing.
As an example, House Bill 1807 says teachers can't be forced to use materials from the New York Times 1619 Project or the book How to Be Anti-Racist. But Walsh says it doesn't block districts from using those works.
Some critics wrongly said that it was banning this course of study or that. Not true. We acknowledge that some teachers may want to use controversial material. Okay. But we want to make sure that no teacher is compelled to use controversial material.
Although 1807 and a separate bill that sought to ban critical race theory did not pass this year, Jerry Price says Washington teachers are worried about ruffling feathers in the course of doing their jobs.
Often they feel like if they bring in a topic that may not be agreed upon by all parties, that they're going to receive blowback. So we spend a lot of time in our professional developments really talking about strategies for engaging with difficult concepts and conversations.
Nearly 2 years into Washington's renewed focus on civics, Margaret Fisher says she thinks the state is doing very well when it comes to civic education. She hopes there will be more funding and opportunities for teachers to get targeted training on civics topics. And she says the teachers themselves are being surveyed this year to find out how things are going from their perspective. Representative Walsh says he will try to pass 1807 again next year. So as Washington teachers and students continue their work in the classroom, debates will continue about what goes in, what's kept out, and who gets to decide. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth reporting.
When we come back, how educators are working to make civics more interesting, both in and out of the classroom. Back in a minute on Soundside. You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman, and today we're kicking off a weekly series along with our colleagues at Spokane Public Radio and Northwest Public Broadcasting about what exactly it means for America to be striving for a more perfect union. And we gotta understand how our democracy works if we want to make it better. So today's topic is civic education. You may have encountered it in high school, learned about voting. Maybe you watched that Schoolhouse Rock episode about how a bill becomes a law.
Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill.
And maybe in that class you felt a little bored trying to cram for the inevitable test before forgetting everything you just learned. Organizations across Washington are trying to make learning civic education a little more compelling. Spokane Public Radio's Doug Nedvornik has our story.
Today I am still just a bill.
Civics education can be pretty dull if it focuses on facts and dates and not the interesting stories behind them. But a partnership of Spokane interests has found a way to make civics cool.
Government, elections, history, and more. How much do you remember from your high school civics courses? Find out in Spokane's very first televised Civics Bowl.
The Civics Bowl program, hosted by public TV station KSPS, brings intrigue to questions about government and politics.
All right, toss up. What is the term length for a Washington State Senator? Connor.
Six.
Community school.
4 years.
Correct. And you get the bonus.
The half-hour show taped at KSPS matches students from Spokane high schools. This one featured four member teams from the community school and Shadle Park. Last year, a pilot version aired online, says Don Bayman from KSPS and the Spokane chapter of the League of Women Voters. The show's creators learned a lot about how to structure the matchups and make the show interesting and keep it running smoothly. And then they had to come up with questions.
What we ended up doing is writing almost 600 questions just in that initial take. Everybody had a minimum of 50 that we were aiming for, and several of our volunteers came up with over 100. So it wasn't as hard as you'd think.
For most of the students, Civics Bowl is their first appearance on television.
We all took it in very different ways. Some showed it more than others, I think. But it was a lot of sitting around like TV is, and it was still really fun, though. I really enjoyed it for sure.
That's David, a member of the community school team, which won its first-round game against Shadle, despite the fact that most of them have not yet taken a civics class. At the community school, civics classes alternate years with U.S. history, and this is the year for U.S. history.
We went into this with absolutely no prior knowledge.
Pretty much just what we learned in middle school, and then we crammed through the textbooks and flashcards and stuff.
Those are team members Sierra and Aster. Their co-coach David Egli says the Civics Bowl has an atmosphere of fun and seriousness.
It's been cool for the rest of the school to be able to watch our team on TV, have somebody to cheer for, but really deep down we're cheering for knowledge. We're cheering for understanding about how our society works.
At Lewis and Clark, the Civics Bowl students are also members of other academic competition teams, such as Knowledge Bowl, which recently finished its season. Coach Megan Gomes and her students quickly pivoted from one to the other.
We read through like the citizenship test cards and, you know, looked up the like presidential succession and look through amendments and, you know, some of that sort of basic civics knowledge.
Next year, Gomes and the students expect to be better prepared. Most of them will have civics next year, perhaps with Gomes, who will teach the subject for the first time. School districts in Washington are required to provide one mandatory half-credit class. Don Bayman from the League of Women Voters would like to see civics taught more and earlier.
I think a senior level class requirement is a great start. Even that requirement's only been in place for, 2 years? And before that, it was decades without even that requirement. This is not to say that teachers haven't been teaching civics, of course, but it's, you know, it's kind of wedged into that already overwhelming syllabus of, you know, government and everything else.
Bayman says students would benefit from more exposure to concepts about government and politics and public life. She says it wouldn't hurt if their parents also received more civics education, and she hopes that's one of the byproducts of Civics Bowl. It appears the program will be back again next year for a second season. I'm Doug Nadvornik reporting.
David Egli and Chelsea Duvall are the co-coaches of the Civics Bowl team at Spokane's Community School. That's a project-based school that's part of the Spokane School District. And they also teach civics when not doing a Civics Bowl. They told Spokane Public Radio's Doug Nedvornik that there are ways to keep students interested in civic education, even when there's no competition involved, if you just make the subject relevant to them.
I love civics because, in my view, it is so pertinent to what's going on now. So my goal is to help students relate what's happening in the news today and issues that they care about with civics, with how our government works, with how everyday people influence the government. Students love it. Like, people think, oh, you know, students think history's boring. But if you make it relatable to them, they are in on it. They want to do it. Even if we're studying things that happened in the late 1700s, if it relates to them, I mean, you know, talk about the Second Amendment or the First Amendment, all these freedoms. So many issues today revolve around things that happened in the past. Once they can see that relationship, the buy-in is easy to get from students.
I'm with Dave. I really love history and civics, and I think that when you have educators who are really passionate about it, it's super easy to make the kids excited about it. So, yeah.
Oddly enough, this school year, we didn't have a civics class. Because our school is small, we have all the juniors and seniors do the same social studies class each year, and then we do the other one next year. So this year we did U.S. history, and then next year we'll do civics and current world affairs, and then the next year we'll do U.S. history, civics, current world affairs. So over those 2 years, all the juniors and seniors get both of the classes. And this year, as the cycle goes, it was U.S. history this year, and we did a lot with hard history, with looking at the U.S.'s past and how that relates to us today. And next year, we'll do civics. We design our own projects. And so civics next year, for example, I'm already designing a project called My Vote, My Voice. And in that one, we're going to take the ballot as if we lived at the community school, so this address, and look at the ballot, see what's on our ballot coming up for November's election, and go through everything on the ballot for our 18-year-old students, which there are always some. Their product for that project is literally their ballot, but they also need to explain why they voted whichever way they chose for each race. So they really get to know the positions of government in that way. They get to know why voting is important and really kind of dive into voting itself, who's on the ballot, looking at different ways of voting, the two-party system, what the parties generally stand for platform-wise.
Yeah.
All these things we can do by doing real-life projects that, you know, there's not a test at the end.
Now, civics education doesn't have to stop when you leave school. At the Cimar Museum of Chicano, Chicana, and Latino-Latina culture in the South Park neighborhood of Seattle, the conversation is turning to the ways we preserve and communicate history. As the first Latino and Chicano museum in Washington state, the Cimar Museum has thought hard about the items and imagery of creating change and where the history of that change should reside. SoundSide's Alec Cowan reports.
History can sometimes feel static, like it's bound to the dates and facts we read about in textbooks. Everything is neatly organized, set in nice fonts and chapters, but the way in which history is actually pieced together, uncovered and discovered, is much messier, told in bits and fragments, and sometimes not spoken at all.
These are a couple of cabins that we located in Sunnyside. These were produced in the 1930s. They're in kit form, so a farmer could buy one, 5, 10, 50 of them and assemble them. And it has held up pretty well.
That's Dr. Erasmo Gamboa, professor emeritus of history at the University of Washington and a curator at the Cimar Museum of Chicano, Chicana, and Latino-Latina culture in South Park, in South Seattle. Right now, we're looking at a very basic cabin, essentially a big wooden box.
There are a few that are still left, but most of them have been knocked down. They weren't kept up. We can come in.
Inside, a small scene is set up. There are a few twin beds in the corners, dining room table, and every nook and cranny is filled with items of all kinds. Kitchen utensils, photos, hand-knit blankets, and children's toys.
How big would you say this is? You know the dimensions?
I think this was like 18 or 20 feet wide, and I think they were 18 by about 10, if I remember correctly. There's no plumbing in here. So all washing of hands, preparing of dishes, and so forth is all done outside.
But why is there a dilapidated cabin inside a shiny new museum in Seattle? It's because of those who once called this cramped living space home.
And so who would be living in these cabins?
Agricultural workers. So the genesis of the Mexican community, particularly after World War II, are migrant workers that come to the Pacific Northwest. And that's what the story we're trying to tell here. Although I should point out that Spanish speakers go back to the early explorations of the Washington coast.
A full family would be living in here as well.
No. Maybe our parents would be here, and then they would utilize maybe the adjacent building on cabins on either side for the rest of the family. Now, they're pretty small.
Washington has a long history as an agricultural powerhouse. In the 1940s and 50s, agriculture was the driver of an experiment in immigration. There was a huge labor shortage due to World War II, and so the government put together something called the Bracero Program, which brought immigrants from Mexico to Washington for work in the fields of central and eastern Washington. At the time, the Bracero Program only brought men to the state, but even after the war, there was a high demand for agricultural labor, and pretty soon entire families were settling in places like the Yakima Valley, living and working in cabins like this one. And while the narrative of that history is preserved in textbooks and historical records, the objects that anchor these stories to the real world are always disappearing.
It took a little bit of work. The farmer who owned these cabins was using it for storage, didn't want to let it go. And then he passed away, and his wife was a former school teacher, and she felt that better use for these cabins would be the museum, so she allowed us to use them, and we stored them for a couple years until the museum was ready, and then we reassembled them here.
It's easy to create a mental picture of what a museum should look like. Things like white walls, wide open spaces, photographs and paintings, priceless artifacts. The Seymour Museum has a lot of those elements, but they also wanted to do something different. This is the first museum dedicated to Chicano and Latino culture in Washington State. And so at the beginning, when Dr. Gamboa started curation, artifacts started coming in from unlikely places and unlikely objects. Things like old government maps that showed immigration routes between Mexico and the Northwest. This is Dr. Jerry Garcia, Vice President of Medical History here at the museum.
The government and growers collaborated together to create maps like this to get workers to the right destination. And at this time period, we're primarily talking about Mexican Americans coming from places like Texas, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado. It's not going to be until the post-1980s that you begin to get people coming directly from Mexico.
The flag here tells you where there's a town. The green, these are areas where you can find work. Okay, Bellingham up there. Here's that red, looks like a little Monopoly symbol. This is where you're going to find housing.
Families hopped into a single truck with all their belongings and traveled thousands of miles for the promise of work in Washington. And don't ask me how, but one of those very trucks is on full display here.
So this truck here is fashioned after this one. And if one of the things that people miss, if you look at the very top of that truck, what do you see? Children, yeah, families back in there. There's the evidence of how people traveled.
While much of the museum focuses on these agricultural routes, it also focuses on the symbols and movements that came afterward. Like Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Virgin Mary in a blue cloak, shrouded in gold light. Her image led many of the United Farm Worker marches.
This is crossing the Skagit River in Burlington, and she's leading the march. And if you look at the photographs of Cesar Chavez, the Virgin is always sort of at the front.
There's a section dedicated to Washington State's Spanish language station, Radio Cardena, and its founder, Irena Mendez.
There is no Spanish language broadcasting anywhere in the Pacific Northwest. This is early 1950s. And this woman is if you read up on her, she is the pioneer in broadcasting.
Several of the artifacts here are actually family heirlooms, donated by Dr. Garcia and Dr. Gamboa themselves.
This is my uniform when I was in Vietnam, a picture of when I was at the Naval Air Station just south of Memphis.
Oh, yeah, this is my mother's high school sweater from Toppenish, Washington. If you look at the other side, you know, her graduation year was 1959. This is actually a picture of my father's. The fifth grade class, that's my father right there. But they put him in the fifth grade and he was 15 years old. Oh, wow. In that picture. He didn't last very long. He was just way too old for that class. But they put him there because of the language situation.
One of the most salient images the museum wants visitors to leave with is one of change. Dr. Gamboa takes me to some billboard-sized photographs just behind the cabins. And here they depict a march in downtown Seattle, taken in the early 1970s.
Because if you see this one, this sign here is being carried. All these, by the way, are Latinos. They were all University of Washington students.
This was a protest against the Vietnam War.
So yeah, Seattle had one of the largest ones after Los Angeles. There were just thousands of people marching against the war in general, but for the Chicanos and Latinos who organized this march, it was because of the high attrition rate, Chicano-Latino soldiers in the Vietnam War. And so it was well attended. This was part of an overall movement within Washington State that really begins at the University of Washington by Chicano Latino students and spreads to other areas of our state and looking at other issues. But this is the spark right here.
As immigrants from Mexico and the U.S. South began to build communities here in Washington, their children inevitably left home. Like Dr. Gamboa, many were the first Latino students at the University of Washington, and they brought a fire for change with them to Seattle, from the United Farm Worker Movement to anti-war protests.
These marches tended to end at Memorial Stadium. you can sort of tell. This is my nephew. I am over here, and I'll show you in another photograph. Members of the Brown Berets, they were sort of the counterpart of the Black Panther Party in Seattle at the time.
Bedroom posters, favorite records, high school sweaters, boxing gloves, a belt for picking potatoes, family photos. Many of these items feel everyday for those who own them. They're possessions rather than artifacts. But what many people don't realize is that those items are threads in the fabric of everyday life. They define cultures and time periods in ways that we don't realize now, but which future generations can hold reverence for. And so the Seymour Museum seeks to present life as it was, the exciting moments, the mundane moments, and especially the moments of change. Dr. Garcia first.
Many of us have branched out of that, the fields of Eastern Washington, but that's where our roots are in the state of Washington, is the agricultural fields. And so we pay a lot of homage to that in our museum in a variety of different ways, from showing instruments that they used to images to songs that were sung. Some of the images are house parties, right? Piñata parties, just your typical stuff. Quinceañeras, weddings, right? One of my favorite pictures is this one here, these two guys just at a bar, just hanging out together, sharing a beer, right? So common in every culture.
And Dr. Gamboa's thoughts.
So here, this idea that immigrants in general, but Mexicans in particular, receive but they don't give. This idea of the wall, which is very much in discussion today with President Biden, amnesty and so forth. And what we wanted to show here is our own contribution to what makes us who we are as a nation and the sacrifices that we have paid.
At the end of our tour, I sat down with Dr. Garcia and Dr. Gamboa to talk about how they view the bigger picture. What are the complications of making a brand new museum, and one for a local community that didn't already have one? Dr. Erasmo Gamboa goes first.
I think another way of looking at this is you have nationally 13% of the population are Latinos or Spanish speakers, are descendants of Spanish speakers, but there's no acknowledgement. There's no place for our presence in a lot of history books, but it's important, I think, to tell the story. When you have communities in Eastern Washington that are 80, 90% of Mexican descent, not all recent immigrants, you have to draw attention to that. And I think those were the kinds of things that spurred the concept of the museum, that we wanted to tell our story. Secondly, you may have already gotten the impression, just the walkthrough that we did, we wanted to tell our story as we saw it. Ours is not a polished, behind glass, you want to go into these cabins, go into the cabins, because we want people to see it up close. We want to tell it in our own terms, and that's the guiding principle for this museum.
You know, we don't follow any kind of standard museum protocols in regards to how to create a museum. We do it, I'll tell you exactly how we call it. We do it the Chicano way, right? The way we want it, right? The way that our community will enjoy it, right? If that means breaking protocols with how the museum study says how to do things, then we'll do it, right? And that's why we love our museum. You know, because of what it showcases, and it's a museum for our community.
You know, the founding of this museum has raised the awareness in other parts of the state. The Yakima Valley Regional Museum now has a sort of a small committee that's advising them about the Mexican presence in Yakima. The Yakima Herald and communities published these books, 100 Years of Yakima History, 100 years of Sunnyside history. I challenge you to pick up those books and show me where we are. And that's changing now because of this. They're saying, wow, if they're doing it over there in the West, in the coast, as they refer to this part of the state, why aren't we doing it here?
What do you see as the significance of having this museum here in Seattle, especially in this particular area of Seattle?
Well, the weight of the population is not, it used to be in Eastern Washington. If you wanted to go to where the action is, so to speak, with regard to Mexican people, you went to Yakima, you went to the Yakima Valley. They're budding communities in SeaTac, in Monroe, all around us.
Yeah. Well, South Park has one of the oldest Latino populations in the whole Seattle area. This is a very, very old neighborhood of Latinos in this section. And, you know, I know right now in our minds, conceptually, we see ourselves doing something over in Eastern Washington, museum-wise, right? That's come out in our conversations. No blueprint yet, but it's in our minds.
The weight of the population, we see it every election, is here, not Eastern Washington. I mean, that's why it's important. Tourists don't go unless they go to do some wine tasting to Eastern Washington. They come here. So we wanted to be here for that reason, to educate.
Are there museums for this kind of history over there, or no? I mean, why not?
Dr. Gamboa.
The push for social change really is rooted in Seattle. It's rooted at the University of Washington. And it's the power that we saw in those images. Not over there. This is not to say that they didn't also. But this is where it starts. In fact, some of those young people that we saw there, there are some images, they went back to Granger, they went back to Sunnyside, and they recruited others to come to the University of Washington. But they should be doing something. The architect who came to the University of Washington, the member of the student movement here, Jose Bazan, he just designed a brand new museum in Granger, and it's going to go up. And it's a smaller museum, but it's beautiful. And I understand that there will be some attention to the history of Mexican people. In Sunnyside, the museum, the city museum, is in an old funeral home. They have a small section on Mexican Americans, Mexican immigrants, migrants. But it's very, very, very small, very, doesn't really tell much of the story. So outside of that, I remember I went to Moses Lake and I asked about artifacts and so forth, and they got upset that I had even asked that why are you asking this? So sort of a reluctance to acknowledge the presence, but it's changing. I think El Sol, for example, and I think also the Yakima papers, I forget the column, they've had several people that are responsible for the column, but sort of they look back to what Yakima was at another time. They're doing a lot of nice pieces on African Americans, Native Americans, and so it's all for the good.
Dr. Garcia.
Yeah, well, what I can see happening over there is, rather than having perhaps one museum like ours for the whole community over there, I can see smaller museums popping up, right? Like in Granger or Yakima or in Grant County, where there's a significant old Latino population there as well, and Moses Lake that he just mentioned. And that might be a better way to go, because it could be that communities take charge of their own space, right, and create their own little museums dedicated to their population there. And that way you'll have, you know, for lack of a way of putting it, you know, kind of like pop-up museums in all these regions in Eastern Washington, rather than having one centrally located.
I mean, imagine with a community that's migrated so many times, I mean, both from Mexico to Texas, from Texas to Washington, from Eastern Washington to Western Washington, the idea of what kind of where certain artifacts kind of quote unquote belong, I assume, comes up pretty frequently.
Yes.
I'm wondering how you navigate, you know, these cabins, they're from, you know, the Central Valley. Like, should they stay there? How do you navigate those kinds of questions?
Dr. Gamboa.
Well, I think if we can preserve them, and we preserve them here, rather than let them deteriorate even more over there, I'd rather have them here. Secondly, I think that out-of-state migration and intrastate migration is important, and people in Seattle ought to get a good understanding of the origins of this community. And I think that's how the story we're trying to tell here.
I wonder, because so many of these artifacts I can see a lot of people kind of dismissing as that's just a work tool, those are old boots. I wonder what that process has been like to gather these artifacts? Because I can imagine that, well, for a lot of people, they see them as pretty everyday. They don't see them as major historical artifacts.
Dr. Garcia.
That's true. I mean, when we went around collecting a lot of this stuff, people don't even realize what they have in their garages or attics until we tell them that, you know, if you got a, one of the things we collected, that we still have some in our warehouse, or hose, right? Back in the day when you clean beets. And people just thought of those as just, you know, just old tools that, you know, they didn't even think about it anymore. But we said, that's perfect for our museum. Right. And so it's a little bit about educating the community about, you know, what are artifacts and why they're important to our community. You know, some are tools and some are photographs. You know, some people have a lot of photographs, but they think they're just my family. They don't mean anything to anybody else. You know, but when you look at those photographs carefully, there's a tremendous amount of history in those images, right, that a lot of people just don't see because they're so close to it, and including my family. Yeah, you know, we have tons of photographs that, you know, if I wasn't involved in history or museums, I would say, oh, they're just family photographs. But once you begin to explain why these images are important, not just to your family, but to our whole community, then people begin to, okay, I get it, I get it. And then, you know, they're willing to share. But yeah, so the artifacts have been fun to collect. It's also been educational on both sides of the fence, so to speak. And it's a continuing process. And we still consider ourselves a new museum, right? And we collect everything. We literally don't turn almost nothing away because we just never know when we'll need it.
But I think the question you're posing is, what is an artifact? That's basically the question, and there is no answer to that. I mean, is a phonograph, for example, an artifact? The debate is, how do you define an artifact? Some of these artifacts might be heirlooms to us, but they're not going to be heirlooms to you. I mean, they're just, as you said, an ordinary pair of work boots, but they're important to those people who wore those boots and depended on those boots to be able to get the job done. So it's that debate. I mean, what is an artifact? And I want to tell you that we had people come in. We asked people to come and talk to us when we first put our committee together. Ron Chu from Wing Luke, and he said, do it your way. We had the curators from the museum at different places. I went to Wasco, Oregon, and they had no trouble with artifacts. They have grills of pickup trucks up against the wall. Those are powerful because they tell the story. And that's kind of, Dr. Garcia was saying, when I see something that I recognize that's important to the community, or I imagine it to be important, if I can get it, I grab it, and it's in our warehouse, and we'll use it. Maybe not today, maybe not next year, but eventually I foresee a use for it.
Just depends on the community. I think every community has a different version or definition, and that's the beauty of, I think, our museum.
That was Soundside producer Alec Cowan speaking with Dr. Erasmo Gamboa and Dr. Jerry Garcia at the CIMAR Museum of Chicano, Chicana, and Latino-Latina Culture in South Park. We'll be right back with more Soundside in a minute. This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman, and we've been spending time in today's show discussing what it means to strive for a more perfect union. When America's founding fathers first wrote the phrase in the preamble to the Constitution, they were operating in a world built primarily to serve white, wealthy, land-owning, and slave-owning men, people like them. So like the Constitution itself, our concept of a more perfect union has needed amending to include every American. People like Stella Winter. Stella is a queer, non-binary activist and independent journalist who hosts a YouTube channel and podcast called Progressive Devilry. They have lived in Washington State their entire life, half in Western Washington and half in Eastern Washington. They spoke to Humanities Washington's Nikki Brueggemann about what democracy looks like to them.
Well, I grew up in Western Washington, but my parents bought some land in Chelan, which is in Eastern Washington, when I was little. So we were spending summers and breaks there. As I grew up, I hopped the mountain a few times when I went to college, got various jobs, and found my career. Now I'm planted in Wenatchee, where my son was born in 2012. I host a YouTube podcast and resource website that focuses on local politics and some state issues called Progressive Devilry. I tried to break down misinformation and make the political battlefield easier to understand and show people how to contact their representatives. I'm a non-binary ace queer, and I'm an activist because too many people are afraid to speak up, afraid of what other people think, afraid of what their family will say or do, and especially here in our community, afraid of losing their jobs and their livelihoods.
You mentioned it just a second ago, but you co-host a podcast called Progressive Devilry.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit more. Why create this podcast and why do this work? Why now?
I noticed in our area specifically, we only have conservative representation in our media. Our local newspaper is conservative. Our local radio stations are conservative. Every piece of media that we consume on Facebook, if it's a local news site, is conservative. So that was one of the biggest reasons why I started Progressive Devilry, because we needed more progressive journalism that wasn't tied to a conservative news outlet.
The Declaration of Independence says, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." As a queer person, how would you define liberty?
Liberty in our country is synonymous with freedom. As a human rights activist, protesting and speaking out are important, especially for underrepresented groups of people who often go unheard. I hope that one day liberty can really mean freedom for everyone to be who they are without the fear of people who hate them, just for how they look or who they love. For some people, it seems liberty is using their rights as a cudgel in order to further oppress other people.
So the word unalienable, this means something that cannot be taken away. As you reflect on the words of the Declaration of Independence, what do you believe are unalienable rights for queer people?
Unalienable rights is such a big and overarching word that, to me, at times seems unrealistic, like a unicorn. For most cis white people, unalienable is their comfort blankie, always unassailable because they've never experienced oppression. And the reality that any right can be taken away from you if enough people think it should be. For queer people and so many other intersectionalities, our right to our rights are as common a topic of conversation as what we're going to have for dinner. So how many unalienable rights can we have if they are constantly debated? Our right to healthcare, our right to marriage, our right to have a family, the right to walk down the street without insults, obscenities, or garbage thrown at you, even our right to housing and food. I believe all of those should be unalienable rights, but the reality is, if you aren't straight, white, and cisgender, your rights are always up for debate, and I hope we can change that.
In Washington State, what do you believe is a barrier to queer liberty that you feel that we need to address?
Hatred, ignorance, and the gleeful spread of misinformation. I had a conversation with a woman just a few months ago who was running for Wenatchee School Board. She was under the mistaken belief that love is a pedophilia reference. I doubt I made her see reason when I explained that it wasn't. And two out of the final six candidates for the school board made openly transphobic comments about a child's right to use the bathroom that aligned with their gender identity, one of which was successfully elected onto the school board. She is also an anti-mask, anti-vaccine advocate, and brings up every school board meeting that we need to unmask our kids, even at the current height of our pandemic. A popular lie is often given more credence than an unpopular truth. Most people seem to be more concerned with confirming their own biases than finding out the truth.
How would you encourage someone to maybe address their bias, challenge it?
always having an open mind is key, but it's checking sources on an article is the easiest way to check a bias. It's so important just to verify that what you're reading is true, and setting aside your bias while hard, there's usually some pretty easy red flags when you're working on confirmation bias.
Do you believe that activism is important to ensuring American democracy is equitable?
I absolutely believe it is important. Without activism, nothing would change. Without activism, we would be most assuredly a fascist state. Your voice is important, and when you join it with others, it becomes increasingly hard to ignore.
That was non-binary activist and independent journalist Stella Winter speaking with Humanities Washington's Nikki Brueggemann. A More Perfect Union is a collaboration between KUOW, Spokane Public Radio, Northwest Public Broadcasting, and Humanities Washington, creating content exploring democracy and civic participation. It's funded in part by the Mellon Foundation. This episode was made by Doug Nedvornik and Brandon Hollingsworth from Spokane Public Radio, Dory Luzo-Gilmore with Northwest Public Broadcasting, Nikki Brueggemann at Humanities Washington, and Alec Cowan, Jason Burrows, Jeannie Yandel, and Sarah Leibovitz at KUOW. I'm Libby Dankman, and you're listening to Soundside from KUOW.